Okay, so we're going to shift gears quite a bit from talking about quantum spin liquids. We'll now go into thinking about the experimental techniques that we have available to probe quantum spin liquids. And I'm going to talk about neutron scattering. And my talk will have three sections to it. First, I'll discuss some of the theoretical framework behind the scattering technique. Then I'll spend some time showing you some of the instruments and talking a bit about how they work. And then we'll give you some examples from neutron scattering experiments that we've done in the area of quantum frustrated magnetism. And the intent of this talk is that it should prepare you so that once we get into the actual session, you'll be fully up to speed or somewhat more up to speed than you would have been otherwise in understanding some of these experimental data from neutron scattering, as well as some of the pitfalls that we have to contend with. For starters, the neutron is a neutral particle. That's important, means it penetrates materials. It has a finite lifetime, about 15 minutes, and decays in this process. The other thing that's important for us is the mass. With that particular number, it turns out that neutrons are a very good probe of dynamic processes in the energy range that's important for sort of sub-thermal physics. And then finally, it has a magnetic moment, and that explains why we're interested in using it for these experiments on frustrated magnets. Now, the experiment itself is actually pretty straightforward, and essentially all of the experiments you'll see involve measuring this so-called neutron scattering cross-section. So even though the details look a little different and so on, it's essentially this same experiment that's going on in various different guises. And just to define a couple of the relevant variables, this would be the incident neutron beam we specified in terms of its wave vector. Momentum of the neutron would be h bar k. And we talk about the flux, which is the rate of neutrons passing through some cross-sectional area per area unit. And typical numbers would be in the range of 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 9th. So this neutron beam, monochromatic in this case, would be incident on a sample. We then define a cross-section, which is the rate of scattering of neutrons divided by the flux. This entity ends up being of dimension of an area because of the flux being in units of an area. And typical cross-section for an atom is measured in units of 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. So about one bond is the unit that we give for that. So that corresponds, in a sense, to the surface area of the nucleus. Then we talk about the scattering cross-sections. And this is the differential cross-section, which is units of bond per steradian. And that is, in a sense, specifying more narrowly which scattering process we're looking at. Namely, the process which has to do with neutrons that pass into this particular solid angle subtended to the sample, which we might denote by d omega. And then this becomes the differential scattering cross-section. If we specify things even more tightly in terms of saying not only that the neutron scatters in this direction, but that it has a certain energy as it leaves the sample, then we talk about the partial differential cross-section, which has units of bond per steradian per millielectron volt. So these are the things that we measure, and we can measure them in absolute units as well. Now, where does the scattering come from? It comes basically from two different interactions. The strong nuclear force gives rise to an interaction potential with the individual bound nuclei, which has this form. It's like a delta function in position space. It's a very spatially localized cross-section, which means that things become very broad in momentum space when we think about scattering associated with this so-called Fermi-Soda potential. And as I mentioned previously, the cross-section for an atom is in the range of one bond. So this cross-section will allow us to learn something about the positions and the dynamics of nuclei in our materials. And the nuclei serve as markers for where the atoms are, essentially. But it happens that we actually, with neutrons, probe the nuclei rather than the charge density. The other interaction that's important is the dipole-dipole interaction. And that one you're familiar with from electromagnetism. It's just the normal interaction between the magnetic dipole moment of the neutron and the internal field distribution in the sample. And what's important here is that the corresponding magnetic cross-section is actually more or less as large as the typical cross-section that is associated with the nuclear scattering cross-section. So it's a good fraction of a bond. And so the magnetic scattering tends to be of the same order of magnitude and strength as the nuclear scattering. And another point I should make about the nuclear scattering cross-section is that as opposed to X-ray scattering, where you're always probing the charge density, and so the cross-section grows dramatically as I go to heavier atoms, with neutrons, it's actually a rather complicated variation in the cross-section, which one can take advantage of if one is a nuclear physicist. I guess one could study those cross-sections and be interested in that. That we don't do, but we do take advantage of the particular values of the cross-sections, and they will allow us to see with very high sensitivity, actually, things like hydrogen and deuterium, carbon, etc., and oxygen, very important for our field. They can be seen very accurately using the neutron scattering technique. Okay, now I'm going to say a few words about these scattering cross-sections, and this is the standard sort of theoretical development that we tend to have in mind as we look at the data. And it's going to progress sort of from the simpler cases to the slightly more tricky cases, and I'll both discuss the nuclear and the magnetic cross-section. So first, I want to think about a sample which is completely static. So I've taken away all the dynamics, and the atoms are just kind of pinned to their perch. And in that case, using the Fermi's golden rule, you end up with the scattering cross-section being sensitive to this mod squared transition matrix element, and this would then be the interaction potential. And so if you write that down in terms of a spatial integral, then you'll find that this is simply equal to the Fourier transformed inappropriate, you know, if we choose the appropriate definition of things, then we can say that we are simply measuring the Fourier transform mod squared of the interaction cross-section. And this is as a function of Q, which is the difference between the incident wave vector and the scattered wave vector. So as we dial in the difference in incident and scattered wave vectors, we are actually adjusting the wave vector that enters into the Fourier transform of the interaction potential. So this is sort of the general statement of this fact. If we have a periodic sample, so spatially periodic, then this Fourier transform will end up having delta functions in it because of the spatial periodicity. And so then this this is what the cross-section will look like, summing over positions in a Bravais lattice. And then the Fourier transform takes the form of a sum of many delta functions that sit right at the locations of the reciprocal lattice vectors of the structure. If it's a nuclear structure, then it would be the chemical reciprocal reciprocal lattice vectors. If it's some sort of ordered magnetic structure, then it would be the magnetic reciprocal lattice vectors. And this expression here is you know, a manifestation, if you will, a more elegant, I think, mathematical manifestation of what we would typically call Bragg's law. And it says that in order to have this type of scattering at all, I need wave vector transfer, Ki minus Kf, to match a reciprocal lattice vector. So here, if I'm thinking about an elastic process where Ki and Kf have the same length, then that's what my scattering triangle looks like. And this is what will be the length of the wave vector transfer. And this is then consistent with the familiar n lambda equals to 2d sine theta expression that we see in earlier derivations of this. OK, so that's for the static sample. And now let's look at the specific case of magnetic interaction cross-section. Again, we're talking about a static sample still. Then I have to put in the magnetic interaction cross-section, and it gets a bit too involved to write all of that down, but suffice it to say that you end up measuring the projection of, well, let me say it like this, you end up being sensitive to the so-called vector structure factor for the spin configuration. So you have to go and sum each position in the magnetic unit cell, and then take the vector describing the direction of the spin, sum it up in this fashion, you get this Q-dependent structure factor. And what we measure in neutron scattering is actually projection of this vector onto the normal plane of wave vector transfer. So probably those who are not doing this for a living, you don't have to worry too much about it, but perhaps the main thing for you to remember is that we have some sensitivity to the directionality of the spin configuration, even if we're not using polarized neutrons. So there's some useful information that can be derived from that. Okay, now if we are Now I'm going to move to a situation of a dynamic sample. So now I'm going to have some sort of dynamics in the system. Then I have to augment my expression in this form, and I can rewrite it introducing the interaction picture in terms of these two-point correlation function, position and time. And I already did the position Fourier transform. So I end up measuring this type of time two-point correlation function of the interaction cross-section. And this formalism could be used either for the nuclear interaction or for the dipole-dipole interaction. And so the upshot of this is that I'm actually sensitive to the Fourier transform of the two-point correlation function in space and time, but for my space variable, I should be associating with it the wave vector transfer, and for the time variable, I'm going to be thinking about the energy transfer. So as you get more and more familiar with scattering, real space becomes more and more unfamiliar and one almost lives entirely in Q energy space. And so that will be displayed, I'm sure, during the conference in looking at these scattering experiments. Okay, so now let's see what is now the augmentation in these expressions as a result of thinking about the dynamic processes. And I'm going to start thinking about nuclei in a harmonic crystal. And what happens now is that I'm going to think about having an average position for those nuclei, but there will be quantum and thermal dynamics associated with the nuclei. And this means that there will be actually elastic scattering. And this elastic scattering looks very much what I wrote down previously, but it's been augmented a bit. It's stated specifically here that it is an elastic process. And then furthermore, there's this Debye-Wall effect that has shown up, which is really a manifestation of the finite sort of thermal smearing, thermal or quantum smearing of the position of the atom as it undertakes this these dynamic processes. So that's all hidden in this factor. So you can actually learn something about the spatial distribution, even by looking at the elastic scattering. Okay, so then comes the inelastic part, which is a little bit complicated. Again, you can look at these if you really want to later. It might be a good sort of reference for you. But I mainly wanted to point out that there are two types of processes that we see, phonon annihilation and phonon creation. And that's actually all that exists in this cross-section in this approximation. So I've gone and said that I only want to think about one phonon processes. Of course, there would be higher order processes as well where I come in and create or annihilate several phonons in one shot, and those would also enter into these expressions. But in the appropriate limits of behavior, we can forget about those and focus on this one phonon part of the cross section. And so now the sort of process that we have to have in mind is incident neutron, scattered neutron, and in the process of scattering and losing some momentum, I give momentum to a phonon. And I also give some energy to the phonon. So that's a simple one-particle process. And a similar process can happen in magnetic systems as a result of the dipole-dipole interaction. And here I'm writing these similar expressions for the case of magnetic scattering. This is the elastic part that we talked about previously. It's this vector structure factor is showing up here, essentially. And the only thing that's really happened as we allowed for dynamics in the system is that I picked up a Debye-Waller factor also in my magnetic cross-section because the atoms are actually rattling around, and so I'm going to broaden my interaction potential and spread and actually suppress things at very large momentum transfer. So that's the elastic part. The inelastic part we typically express in terms of this dynamic correlation function SQ of omega. There's other stuff that's appeared out front which is quite similar to what's in the elastic cross-section. But let's focus on this part of the expression, which typically has our interest. But maybe before I do that, I want to emphasize that experimentally, we're able to deal with all of these factors and actually have a real absolute unit measurement of this whole entity. But let's look at S of Q and omega in the next slide, which in a sense is the mathematical framework where experiment and theory can meet as we talk about these frustrated magnets. And here's the expression for that. And as we had seen previously, we were talking about a two-point space and time correlation function. And in looking at these scattering data, there are various results from statistical physics that are quite useful for us to have available. And these are simply based on the approximation, if you will, that the sample is in thermodynamic equilibrium. So once we've said that, then we have these types of results appearing, so-called detailed balance expression, fluctuation dissipation theorem, and there are also some other rather handy expressions that are known and that are too much for you to really focus on right now, perhaps. But I want to emphasize that these types of expressions, which are sort of rock solid in their theoretical background, are very, very useful for us to check on possible flaws of various types in the experiment and in the whole measurement protocol. If we see failures of some of these expressions, then we have to be quite worried about what's going on and have to really look into that. So we hold these very dear. All right, good. So that was section one, about 15 minutes. And then I'd like to now turn to a little bit about how we actually do these experiments. And there I have to apologize to the theoretical crowd. On the other hand, maybe it's interesting for you to see what it actually looks like when we carry out these experiments. It ends up being quite removed, if you will, from the theoretical framework that I just described. A lot of additional concerns enter into the discussion. And the first question, of course, is where do you get the neutrons from? They're normally bound up tightly in nuclei, and you can release them either by a fission or a spallation process. And the fission, both of these processes are used. And in the fission process, you typically will find sources that have very high time average flux and which are steady state. So they're just sort of constant sources in time, a constant beam of neutrons in time. On the other hand, in the spallation technique, you are creating neutrons by sending energetic protons to a dense sample or to a dense target. And then it's possible to actually transfer the time structure of the proton beam into a time structure for the neutron beam. And this becomes a very, very powerful way of increasing effectively the brightness of the source by condensing it or focusing it in time. So I know exactly when the neutrons are going to appear. That's the distinction, if you will, experimentally, time-independent source of neutrons and pulsed, typically pulsed source of neutrons. There are also steady-state spallation sources, and those also have their qualities. But in general, this is the distinction between the two processes. And now the neutron scattering technique has, and I think remains, has been and remains a flux-limited technique. And you can think of that in a positive term, in the sense that there are many, many things you could do if you had a higher flux of neutrons. And we're always, in a sense, struggling a bit to have enough neutrons. And we'll never, I think, be at the limit of, or the same flux rates that you see when you're talking about lasers or X-ray sources and so on. So as we said, we're talking about a source average flux of 10 to the 14th neutrons per second or so. So it's really very, very low intensity source. And over the years, there have been improvements to that. In the sort of 60s and 70s, there was the establishment of the first reactors, reactor-based sources, that is, fission sources that were sort of specialized for neutron scattering experiments. But there was quite a long period of time where there was not much development in the flux on sample. But with the advent of this spallation technique, where you use a proton accelerator to create neutrons, there's now sort of a new curve, which in a sense has to do with the time structure that is put into the to the neutron source using these spallation techniques. And so we're actually in quite an exciting period of time here where neutron sources such as the SNS in Oak Ridge and JPARC in Japan and coming online before too long as well, a Chinese pulse spallation source and also European pulse spallation source, and I think these sources are really opening up a lot of new opportunities in the field of scattering. So, as you can see, neutron scattering is something you do at facilities which are located in specific places around the world. So, if you want to really be doing neutron scattering, you also have to be accepting of the suitcase physicist style, and you will be traveling around quite a bit. And in that sense, I should show you the neutron scatterers map of North America. There are, I think, four main facilities that are being used for neutron scattering. At Los Alamos, there's a pulse spallation source. At Oak Ridge National Lab, there's both the reactor source and the spallation source. At NIST, there's a reactor source, and not too far away from where we are now, there is Chalk River Nuclear Laboratories, where there is a reactor source as well. So I'm going to say a few words about the instrumentation at the places I probably know best, which is the NIST facility and the SNS facility. And here's a picture from the NIST facility, which involves a 20 megawatt fission reactor source, some instruments clustered close to the reactor, and then a bunch of instruments sitting in so-called neutron guide holes. The neutrons are brought from the source of in the fission reactor to the instruments out here through the process of total external reflection. So it turns out you can do something like a waveguide for neutrons that can transport neutrons over hundreds of meters without appreciable loss, and you can actually bring them out to here where there'll be a lower background and a generally more conducive environment to doing experiments. It's still pretty cluttered. Here's a picture from the guide hole. It's actually some years back, as some of you will know. And to focus on a specific instrument that's been used quite a bit for some of this frustrated magnetism, here's a rather conventional, pretty conventional cold neutron triple axis spectrometer. And it's actually built, in, if you will, in the mold of the instrument of Bertrand Brockhaus, who, as you know, is associated with the conference through our chairman. And so this is basically the same layout. There's a certain incident wave vector which is defined by a crystal monochromator that sits in here. And then there's a single detector which can detect just one scattering event at a time with a specific final wave vector transfer. And by basically taking incident wave vector minus scattered wave vector, we'll figure out how much momentum was transferred to the sample. And we can also figure out how much energy by taking the difference of the incident energy minus the final energy. So this is what the detector system looks like inside. And I just wanted to show that there really is just one detector. This thing here is just a single detector. And when the instrument sits in a certain location, it is detecting only one scattering event, a certain wave vector transfer and a certain energy transfer. And it sits there for a while, then you move it to another place and detect another event. And so it's actually not that efficient for mapping out momentum space, but it is very good at sort of mapping out scans with very high signal-to-noise ratio. Anyway, we were interested in being able to map momentum and energy transfer very, very much more widely than is possible on that machine. So we built the so-called MAX spectrometer at NIST. This one is sitting very close to the reactor. The reactor sits right back here. And the main distinction from the previous instrument is that the detector is now a much larger structure. It's still white, but it now is actually has 20 detectors sitting inside looking at the sample simultaneously. So if I put this in some specific location, it's detecting simultaneously 20 different scattering events. So you get a big boost in efficiency. And furthermore, we have a special type of focusing monochromator which has boosted the intensity on sample by a factor of 50. And so overall, you get a much higher efficiency for these experiments that map out a whole range of momentum, energy, space. And this is what the detector looks like. You can see all of these actual crystal monochromating systems, and each of those will have a detector associated with them. Each of these wires is a certain detector. And then it's all closed up and moved to the sample and can then be very efficient at parallel detection of neutron scattering events. The other instrument I wanted to just mention is the neutron spin echo technique, which I think also has had a strong impact in frustrated magnetism. And here's the instrument at NIST Center for Neutron Research. The most prominent feature you see are two huge solenoids. And actually, the way it works is that there's a field. This coil will have a field pointing in that direction, and this coil will have a field pointing in the opposite direction. And the incident neutron will travel through that field, and then it'll need to travel through that coil as well, and then eventually reach the detector. And you can say, why do I need this field? I need the field because I want to see a precession process. And in fact, I think the main thing I want to say with this slide is that as opposed to the conventional instrument that I previously described, this triple axis type spectrometer, where I define the incident state of the neutron and I define a certain scattered state of the neutron, and then I measure the probability of transitions between those two states. This instrument is fundamentally a self-interference phenomenon. So the neutron actually, as it moves through the system, will carry its own clock. And so I can actually use a very broad range of neutron energies and still achieve an extremely good energy resolution. And so, in fact, what happens, and maybe you could study these formulas if you're interested in the quiet of your room, but it's fundamentally a measurement of the polarization projection of the neutrons onto some chosen direction. And it turns out that that will be a measurement of the time correlation function. So you have the spatial part of the correlation function is still encoded in Q as wave vector transfer, but instead of energy transfer, you're now looking in real time. And the time variable has to do with this field integral. That means that this thing here, which is the integral of the field times displacement through the incident and scattered solenoid, and it has to do with the wavelength of the neutrons raised to the third power. So if I want to measure things at very long time scales, I need to use a very high magnetic field, and I need to use a very large, very long wavelength, essentially. And with that technique, one can actually reach out to tens of nanoseconds in Fourier time. Okay, so now a couple of words about the pulsed spallation sources, and here I'm going to show you pictures from the SNS at Oak Ridge National Lab. It's a 1 megawatt facility which is operating at around 95% reliability and is available for your applications. There's a whole suite of instruments, as is typically the case for these sources. Some of them are not of particular interest for frustrated magnetism, but several of them are. And the ones I wanted to mention in particular is a powder diffractometer. A lot of the work we do relies on knowing the structure of the material very well. And neutrons, as mentioned, are very good at determining the positions of light atoms, such as oxygen. And so those are measured well with neutron technique. And with this pulse spallation source, the way it works, it's quite elegant, is that you get a pulse of neutrons which carries a whole band of different energies or a whole band of different wavelengths. And then as a function of time, as this pulse moves towards the sample, it spreads out. The faster neutrons are moving faster, the slower neutrons are going to reach the sample later. They interact with the sample in a diffraction process, the normal Bragg diffraction process. And then they continue mostly elastically scattered towards the detector. And according to the time of arrival, I'll be able to work out what was the wavelength of those neutrons. And so you can put all of this together and use the full pulse white beam and use a broad range of scattering angles. And that's what's being done in this PowGen instrument at the spallation neutron source. And you'll see that the detector is this huge object that completely surrounds the sample and detects a very broad, a very wide range of solid angle. This instrument is actually not completely finished, but when it is, it'll have 40 square meters of detectors surrounding the sample and achieve a substantially high sensitivity than we are familiar with. For inelastic scattering, technique is also based on time of flight because that's the strength of the spallation technique. And this is what such an instrument looks like. This is a so-called Sequoia time of flight inelastic machine that I know Bruce and his group has used extensively. Fundamentally, what's happening there in terms of determination of the energy transfer, that two times are being associated with each scattering event. There's a time at which the neutron passed through a chopper, which is actually a rotating Fermi chopper, and then there's a time at which the neutron was detected at the detector. And from the time where the neutron reached the chopper, you determine the incident velocity, and from the detector time, you essentially determine the final velocity, and from those you can then back out energy transfer and wave vector transfer. And I think the key with this instrument in terms of its efficiency is that it's a relatively low complexity detection system. You saw the very complicated instrument at the reactor source with many, many mechanical things and so on. This machine has simply a time sensitive detection system, so you know when the neutron arrived, and you know where it arrived. And from that, you can then back out momentum and energy transfer and cover a very, very wide range of energy and wave vector transfers. And this chart is one that's important for designing your experiments. It shows the chart of energy transfer versus wave vector transfer, and each instrument at a facility such as the SNS covers a certain sort of region of this wave vector energy transfer space. And so depending on what the energy scale for your system is and what kind of process you're interested in, you'll look at a chart like this and then decide which instrument you should be using. Okay, so that was another 15 minutes mostly talking about instrumentation. And then for the last 15 minutes, we'll give a couple of examples, actually not of the very, very latest stuff, but just things I picked out to try to illustrate the various types of techniques that are used to probe frustrated magnets with neutron scattering. And the first one is really very familiar probably to many of you. I picked something I had on the computer here, which is a material which is actually a quasi two-dimensional, almost triangular lattice system. But it's in the semi-classical limit, spin is 3/2, and it is slightly distorted. So it actually has an orthorhombic distortion and somewhat complex set of interactions. And what I'm showing you here is how powder neutron diffraction is used to learn about the structure of this type of material. And shown here is a powder diffraction pattern from the PowGen machine that I indicated previously. And what you see are some sharp peaks up here at low values of d. D is 2 pi over q, so somehow crystallographers like to talk about d rather than q, so that's how we typically plot these things. So these sharp peaks are actually telling us something about the nuclear structure, and we get from them the location and oxygen stoichiometry of a material such as this, because the neutrons are very sensitive to oxygen. And then we also have another peak which is broader and which vanishes as you heat up. And that peak is indicates the development of some sort of static magnetic ordering in the system. And from refining the so-called Rietveld refinement, we can determine these things that I've listed down here. We can determine the magnetic wave vector. And that tells us what is the direction along which the magnetic structure is modulated. We can determine the dimensionality and range of magnetic correlations. And in this case, you'll see that this peak is actually somewhat broadened, and the particular line shape and so on can actually hold interesting information about the dimensionality of the spin configuration, even though I'm just looking at a powder sample. And then finally, if I know something about group theory of magnetic structures, then I can distinguish between symmetry-allowed magnetic structures by doing refinements of these types of patterns. So that's a typical use of powder diffraction. Okay, then I want to talk a bit about diffuse scattering as measured in a single crystal. There will be two examples, one that you're probably not familiar with, and that's this one, and the next one which you will be much more familiar with. And I was going to make a contrast between those two. This is a little bit of an outlier because I'm looking here at an iron chalcogenide superconducting material, the 1-1 type compound. And I just wanted to show you an example of diffuse elastic scattering measured on the MAX instrument. So this is this instrument at NIST, which is very good at mapping out broad range of momentum space. And these two charts, this one, are experimental measurements of elastic scattering versus momentum transfer. And you see very broad features in momentum space. That's unusual. Normally, you would see sharp Bragg peaks associated with some long-range ordered structure. And in this case, it turned out that this diffuse scattering was actually associated with what we're calling a Friedel oscillation set up in the vicinity of an interstitial ion site. And so by refining these patterns measured in a broad range of momentum space, you can actually back out in real space the spin configuration surrounding such an interstitial ion site. Now, an important thing to notice in these data is that all the features are broad in momentum space. There's nothing really sharp to be seen. And that is an indication that these are finite-sized structures. Things that are broad in momentum space are also also have a finite range in real space. If I have very, very sharp things in momentum space, then I have infinite range things in real space. So this contrasts with the case of our of Fennell et al.'s celebrated experiments on holmium titanate. These are polarized neutron diffraction experiments, and I won't go into why so much into why they were polarized experiments, but I wanted to call your attention to two things about these patterns. Number one, they're very broad in momentum space. So we don't have sharp peaks, so we don't have a periodic structure in real space. It just drops straight out from looking at the data. However, we do have some very sharp features, these pinch point features that have been discussed, and they indicate that there's some sort of very long length scale in the problem. And that long length scale, it turns out, will be associated with the distance between these types of defect, if you will, tetrahedra in the frozen spin ice type state of that material. So if you take a cut in momentum space through this particular location, then you find these beautiful plots as a function of temperature that show that you have a very sharp peak there. And the sharpness, again, in momentum space means that I've got some sort of very long length scale. And in fact, Fennell et al. Were able to measure the corresponding length scale as a function of temperature. So even though I don't have Bragg peaks, there is this sharp aspect to it which indicates some very long length scale in the problem picked out with a so-called coherent diffuse scattering. And this is a case, actually, in which the experiment, which is shown up here, almost looks nicer than the theory itself. So there's a really beautiful example there. I want to show you one set of data from spin echo measurement, which in particular in the case of spin ice have had important impacts. And this is going to show you the time scale that can be accessed using this self-interference technique or neutron self-interference technique. And you can see that they can measure in time, so it's the time correlation function, up to a time scale of several nanoseconds. I think state of the art is now progressing as the field strength increases and as the wavelength increases. Those were the things we mentioned that control the range of time that you can actually access. Okay, then I wanted to give you a couple of examples of inelastic, so real inelastic magnetic scattering processes. And before showing you the data, I wanted to remind you of two different types of situations that we might have. I mentioned the case of one phonon scattering where we have phonon creation and phonon annihilation. And this can be generalized to the magnetic case where I may have some sort of magnon creation, magnon annihilation process. And those types of processes will always give you a sharp line through energy momentum space. And this is what's happening when we have a single particle scattering process that is taking place in which the neutron is simply delivering some energy and momentum to one particle. But if you're in a situation in which there are actually two particles involved, then even though you control the sort of the overall momentum delivered, you would not know in the scattering process how much momentum is delivered to particle one and particle two. And as a result of that, you may actually have a spectrum of scattering at a given fixed momentum transfer. So that's our indication in scattering at low temperatures that we have some form of multi-particle process going on. So there's a lot of interest now in, as we heard in the previous talk by Young-Baek Kim, in systems which fundamentally have spin and type excitations. And what we should expect in scattering experiments is actually the appearance of these continua of excitations. And so it is fortunate that a lot of the new instrumentation which is now coming online is particularly good at looking at these types of continua, much, much better than the instrumentation that we were formerly accustomed to. So let's see. So I was going to show you, an example of an experiment first of the sort of normal type of excitations. And so here I'm picking a very simple, a relatively simple compound, which we won't talk very much about in detail. Suffice it to say that this is a quasi two-dimensional material of almost ferromagnetic planes, which are coupled together antiferromagnetically. We initially looked at it because we thought it was very frustrated, but it turned out not to be so frustrated, predominantly quasi low-dimensional. And so let me show you the images of inelastic scattering that you get using this type of instrument, the MAX instrument. And what we naturally measure in that machine are these slices at fixed energy transfer. Here is 2.5 millivolts, and then you can work yourself up in energy transfer, and you see these sharp sort of features in momentum space, which correspond to cutting through the dispersion relation. And those can be compared to a model of spin wave excitations in that compound in order to establish the exchange constants. And here's an example of the more conventional way of looking at such data, where we take several of these slices and then plot them as a function of momentum and energy transfer. And then you get the normal lines through energy momentum space, which again can be compared between experimental results and theoretical results. So that's the sort of normal behavior of a magnet, which is in some sort of ordered state and which has spin flip excitations, so fundamentally magnum type excitations. But here's a system which is quite different from that. It's a material that Nakatsu Giardel wrote about in 2005, and it's a spin 1 triangular lattice antiferromagnet with competing near and third near neighbor interactions. And in this material, we tried various ways to look at the magnetic excitations, and what was eventually successful was using this MAX instrument. And so I'm again going to show you slices in energy in momentum space at fixed values of energy transfer. So here's the elastic position where you see some broadened peaks indicating a finite correlation length of a quasi-elastic type state. And then as you come up in energy transfer, these features become broadened, but still kind of center around the same locations in energy momentum space, and you can keep coming up. And then eventually you go beyond the magnetic bandwidth. And these types of data can then again be shown as a function of momentum and energy transfer. And what you find is a really very unusual type of excitation spectrum, which features not sharp lines through energy momentum space, but actually a whole continuum of excitations reaching out so that at any given momentum transfer, you have really a whole range of energy transfer. So this is again consistent with a multi-particle type excitation in that type of frustrated magnet. Okay, now I want to just conclude here. It's been a little bit, maybe a bit rapid progression through various subjects. And I hope that it'll help you to understand the talks that will be coming up. If you became more interested in learning about neutron scattering, you wanted to advertise a course that will be taught online actually in the fall. And it's been announced here. If you Google neutron QCMP, then you'll see more information. So you'll be able to see lectures by various people describing the neutron scattering technique and the latest instrumentation. So to summarize, neutrons provide information in the right length and time scale. And in frustrated magnetism, we can probe dynamic and frozen short-range order, determine complex magnetic structures, and probe various types of spin excitation. And I wanted to sort of draw your attention to the fact that there's a lot going on in instrumentation just around this time, which is opening up new opportunities for interesting science using neutrons. So thank you for your attention. Okay, yeah, the question was that Lucille had heard of some particular materials which are sort of off limits for neutron scattering because of certain nuclei. So this is where the nuclear physics eventually comes back to bite us, because I said that we had, in a sense, an advantage in that the nuclei had varying scattering lengths as we went through the periodic table, but then there are certain elements which actually have some resonance processes where they would like to absorb a neutron and go into some excited state, and then they'll decay into some other nuclei. It's not going to damage our sample, but it leaves the neutron behind inside the sample, so we can't see it as it comes out. And cadmium is an example of that. So we actually use cadmium to shield neutrons. If you put a sheet of cadmium, then you've almost absorbed 99.9% of neutrons if the wavelength is sufficiently long. So a sample which has cadmium in it will be very difficult to look at. Not impossible. Not impossible, because there are always ways out. One way is to find an isotope of that same element which does not absorb neutrons. And if you're rich enough, you can usually find such an isotope. Not always. So in some cases, and one of those is holmium, right? Yeah. So there you just don't have it. So you cannot, there's no other nucleus that you could have. In the case of dysprosium, actually some of those beautiful experiments were possible because they invested 30,000 or some significant amount of money in buying the appropriate isotope, so then they could do the experiment. So certain materials are just not good, but fortunately I'd say that 80%, a good fraction of the periodic table is fine. It's just there's some that are not good.